everyone. Welcome to Stutter Talk at episode 640 with Dr. Jennifer Chesters joining us today from Great Britain. Are you in Oxford?
I am, yes.
Oh, well, thank you for joining us from the other side of the pond. I just love saying that. This is the Transcranial Direct Current Stimulation in Stuttering Treatment Edition. And our guest today, as I said, is Dr. Jennifer Chesters. She is a neuroscience researcher and speech language therapist at the Oxford Department of Experimental Psychology. Dr. Chesters is a postdoctoral research fellow on a team led by Kate Watkins, who's a past guest on Stutter Talk, and they are investigating the neural basis of stuttering using a range of brain and imaging and stimulation techniques. And Dr. Chesters is first author of the recently published study, Transcranial Direct Current Stimulation Over Left Inferior Frontal Cortex Improves Speech Fluency in Adults Who Stutter, in the journal Brain, a journal of neurology. And it's really cool that that article is freely available. So if you go to stuttertalk.com at episode 640, you can find it there. So if it's all right with you, I'll very briefly summarize your research and then ask you a bunch of questions about it.
That sounds great. Yeah, go ahead.
So you had 30 male subjects, and they all received 5 days of behavioral fluency intervention for 20-minute sessions. And the behavioral interventions were choral speech and metronome timed speech. So choral speech is when two people or more talk at the same time. And actually, could you give us an example of what the metronome time speech is?
So metronome time speech is speaking in time with a rhythmic beat. So we just use the beep of a metronome. Actually, I played it on my iPhone. And we ask the participant to speak in time with that beep. So they're placing one syllable on each beat.
And then you would make it just a little bit faster to make it more natural sounding?
Yeah. So in this study, actually, we started with it fairly slow. It was always in the range of what we'd kind of consider a normal speaking rate, but we started on the slower end of that and moved it slightly faster. So we were aiming to get it as close as possible to the speaker's kind of natural speaking rate. It can be a little bit difficult to begin with to speak at the faster rate. It just sounds fast. I think often we're not aware of how fast we talk. So we moved it up slowly just so it kind of felt more comfortable to the participants.
Excellent. So out of your 30 subjects, 15 of them received transcranial direct current stimulation, and the other 15, which were the control group, received a sham treatment, which was an extremely light stimulation that was not considered clinically significant. And the results were that 1 week later, the treatment group had less stuttering during read aloud and conversation. However, 6 weeks later, the effect had worn off for conversation, but there was still reduced stuttering for read aloud. So let's just get one thing out of the way. This type of transcranial direct current stimulation in the media and some in the stuttering community have referred to it as electroshock or zapping or jolting. Mm-hmm. Is this painful, or describe it in your own words, please?
Sure. So first of all, thank you very much for having me on the program, Peter. Great to be here.
Thank you.
I think there is some confusion when people think of electrical methods of stimulating somebody's head or somebody's brain. Because I guess the popular or the most well-known technique would be electroconvulsive therapy, which has been used to treat psychiatric conditions. What we're dealing with is something completely different. So transcranial direct current stimulation involves using a tiny current. So it's about 0.01% of the current that you would use to power a light bulb. It's a tiny amount of current that we pass between pads that we place on somebody's head. And what we're aiming to do is to prime their brains for learning. Our brains use electrical currents to send messages. So we're kind of just priming or boosting that natural process. It feels like an itch or a tingle generally at the beginning of the stimulation. And that's just the nerve endings in your skin having, as the current passes through them, being stimulated. Following that, generally, people don't feel anything at all. It's really quite comfortable and it's entirely safe.
Yeah. And I was so online in the stuttering community, there was a lot of excitement about your research. And there was also some folks who seemed very concerned. And I'm going to say they sounded a bit alarmist at times. And there was some concern about memory loss. Is there any evidence that this could cause memory loss?
Absolutely not. No, I think this must also come from the confusion with ECT, because that is known to have some effects on short-term memory. And there's been a lot of research, safety studies into using transcranial direct current stimulation, or TDCS as we call it. And there are very clear parameters in terms of safe use of the technique. There have been no recorded incidences of any serious side effects. Basically, the side effects that have been recorded are an itch or tingle to do with the skin stimulation. Very occasionally, people have a bit of a headache following it, but it was very short term. So in terms of kind of the safety of the technique, it's a very safe technique. We do screen out, because we're using an electrical current, we wouldn't want to do that with anybody who had a condition that involved their brain using electrical messages in a kind of disrupted way. So, for example, somebody who had a seizure disorder such as epilepsy, we would screen out from the study. But in terms of people that don't have anything that would mean that their brain is using electricity in an abnormal way, that there are no risks associated with having TDCS.
So this is a randomized controlled trial that we're talking about, and that's often referred to in our field and other fields as the gold standard. Could you let our listeners know briefly why this level of research is considered so high?
Sure. So I guess I'll take each part in turn. So the randomization just means that you would gather a group of people to take part in this study, and then they'd be randomly allocated to the groups involved. So in our study, we had an active TDCS group, and we had a control group who had a sham stimulation, and we randomly allocated people to one or the other group. So there shouldn't be any systematic bias in any characteristics of the people in one group or another because they've been randomly assigned. So that gives a level of robustness to the study. Then the control refers to the fact that you have a group that aren't having the intervention that you're interested in. So we had a group of people that had sham stimulation. One of the benefits of TDCS is it's really easy to have a sham condition. So this is a condition where you don't want the person who's receiving the TDCS to know if they're in the real or the control group. You also don't want the researcher delivering the intervention to know, so that there can be no bias. And the reason it's very easy to do this with TDCS is because we have this itch or kind of tingle at the beginning of stimulation that I've already spoken to you about. And what you can do is turn the stimulator on for a really, really short period of time, and you get the same itch or tingle sensation. And then in the sham group, you turn the stimulation off. In the active group, the itch and the tingle only lasts kind of for a minute maximum at the beginning of the stimulation. So actually, those sensations are exactly the same for the two groups. The other thing that's important is the double blinding. So that's what I just referred to in terms of the participants and the researcher not knowing which group they're in. So these are just many stages of making sure that the study is well controlled and that there can be any kind of biases. So any effects you see, you're quite convinced would be down to the intervention you're interested in.
So the speech language pathologist who was judging the levels of stuttering at 1 week and 6 weeks didn't know who had the treatment and who did not.
Yeah, that's right. So in fact, it was me who was doing the intervention. Right up until the point that the intervention had been completed and all the data had been analyzed, everyone involved in that intervention and the analysis was blind to what condition each participant was in. So it was right at the end that we were able to then use codes. So the stimulator allowed us to have a individual code for each person, which had no identifying information about which condition they were in. And right at the end, we could use those codes to then split the groups into the active and the control group and look at our results. So nobody knew which group anybody was in who was involved in the study until right at the end. So it's a good way to know that we couldn't have biased in any way the result.
And just to remind the listeners, the big result was that at 1 week after the treatment, stuttering was reduced in both conversation and read aloud. And then at 6 weeks post-treatment, the stuttering was reduced only for read aloud, but not for conversation. But before we so is there anything you want to say about the big result before we move on?
I mean, I guess the interesting question for us really was where the difference came with these two tasks. So when we identified kind of the outcome we're most interested in, we combined our measure of reading and conversation together, but then we were interested in if there were any differences between the two. And there tend to be some differences. So some of our participants found that they stuttered more on conversation or reading to begin with. So we kind of were interested in the sensitivity for those two different tasks. And I think it's really interesting that we got the more robust effect on reading. But of course, in terms of usefulness clinically, the effect on conversation is the more interesting. I guess we wondered really whether the effect on reading may have been more robust because reading tends to be a more sensitive measure of stuttering. There tends to be less ability of people to avoid difficult sounds or words because you're just reading the text from the page. So it might be that kind of increased the sensitivity to seeing the change. But we'd be really interested in future to see what we could do to make the effects on conversation last for longer or be kind of larger. Because I think that would be clinically a more useful outcome, really.
This is Stutter Talk. I'm Peter Reitzis here with Dr. Jennifer Chesters, who's at the Oxford Department of Experimental Psychology. We might have just heard Dr. Chesters' rabbits in the background, but I think you've stowed them away, so I think we are good to go. Why is your team looking at transcranial direct current stimulation? Has it proven effective in areas related to stuttering?
So I guess our interest was first drawn to it because it was investigated first in motor disorders or actually just in motor function. So there were some studies just looking at whether or not motor control could be changed in any way by applying TDCS during a motor task. There also have been some studies looking at people with speech, language and communication conditions. So following stroke, if somebody has aphasia, there have been a few trials looking at whether or not those aphasic symptoms, whether kind of looking at language, so looking at naming, for example, or looking more towards speech ability, those could be improved by using TDCS. And there were promising findings, both looking at those kind of communication effects and also motor effects. And from brain imaging studies, we know, so both our studies done by our team and teams across the world, we know that there are differences in the brains of people who stutter in terms of kind of speech motor control. So there was a rationale there for looking at whether or not we could interact with the speech motor system in people who stutter to get some beneficial effects in terms of reducing the amount of stuttering.
And I remember a few years ago seeing parents were talking about this type of stimulation on an apraxia group, and and some parents, they wanted to know, hey, could we use this type of treatment for apraxia? So I think it's interesting that it's being looked at in a range of speech and motor areas.
Yeah, so I mean, I've seen some studies looking at acquired apraxia and people following stroke. I haven't seen anything in developmental apraxia, but I think this is an interesting question. It's probably worth mentioning that we have been doing our studies in adults, and we probably wouldn't look towards doing the studies in children because with a developing speech and language system, we don't fully understand really the reasons why some children will persist in stuttering and some children won't. So I think that we decided really to have a look at people with a persistent stutter where their speech and language system was fully developed, but there was this difference in the way that it was working. We decided that that was kind of the best approach really to look at the adult speech and language system.
Yeah, I wonder if you would be able to get this research approved on children.
I'm not sure. I mean, I think TDCS research has been really well controlled and is very safe, but it's still very new. And I mean, really, this is the first randomized controlled trial of TDCS in people who stutter. So I kind of think there are lots of questions that we would want to look at in terms of how we could interact with the speech motor systems of adults who stutter. And there would really be no need and not a clear enough understanding of the developing speech and language system of children who stutter to go there. I can't really answer the question of whether or not it would be approved. I know as our team, we wouldn't be really interested in going there, at least for the time being.
We have a bunch of listeners at Stutter Talk who are very interested in new fluency treatments are to reduce stuttering, as I like to say, and that's one of the reasons I invited you on air. But we also have we have a ton of listeners, including myself, who are also very interested in it's okay to stutter and acceptance and facing our stuttering. So let me ask you a few questions about that. Your study found very minimal psychosocial improvement. In other words, while the subjects were stuttering less for read aloud at 6 weeks, they did not report feeling better about their stuttering. What do you say to folks who read your study and hear our conversation and they think, well, how can treatment be effective if people who stutter don't feel better?
Sure. I think one thing to clarify is we used the sham group to compare how much benefit we got from the TDCS. And what we actually found was no additional benefit of the TDCS on any psychosocial measure. But actually both our sham group and our TDCS group did show a more positive feeling. So they scored kind of towards a more positive end on that assessment. So actually what we found was overall being in the study improved people's feelings about stuttering. This isn't massively surprising finding in terms of placebo effects. And quite often people just by being involved in a study, whether or not it was being involved with people who knew that they stuttered, who were very positive towards them stuttering, who didn't judge them for stuttering, felt more, enabled them to feel more positive about their speech, or whether it was just taking some kind of positive action in terms of helping general understanding about stuttering, we're not entirely sure why, but there was an overall move towards a more positive psychosocial measure. In terms of the question of why would it matter if your fluency improves if you don't overall improve in how you feel about living with your stutter, I would completely agree that once this comes to a point of being clinically rolled out, if it does, that we would want somebody to feel positive, and we wouldn't want it to just be a placebo effect. We'd want it to be a true effect of the TDCS. And I think that's something that we need to think about moving forward. And other teams working in this area need to think about the best way of combining this approach in a really holistic way of supporting people who stutter to kind of get the kind of improvements that they want, whatever their goals might be. We've kind of got a long way to go there, but we did see positivity in terms of psychosocial consequences, just not due to the TDCS.
So I'm always interested about that because I wonder if when the subjects were going to your treatment, if they were talking to other subjects in the waiting room and if they were talking to you all about stuttering in general and maybe just so I don't know if they met other stutterers during this research or if they were just asking you questions about stuttering.
So they didn't meet other people who stuttered. We kind of saw one person at a time through the study, but we certainly, although our focus was looking, and our primary outcome was looking in terms of fluency, because it made sense. We were targeting parts of the brain that support fluent speaking. We absolutely were talking to people who took part in the study about their lives, about how they felt about their speech, about kind of how we saw kind of working with people who stutter. And of course, we're very pro stuttering pride, or stammering pride as it's called in the UK, and kind of self-acceptance and enjoying kind of collaborating in our research with people who stutter. So I guess just being in that sort of environment would help, would make people feel positive.
What about this? And this might sound off the wall, but sure. So you looked at TDCS in conjunction with behavioral stuttering treatments of choral speech and metronome time speech. What about the possibility of using TDCS with things like voluntary stuttering, or with advertising stuttering, with telling other people you stutter, with practicing talking openly about stuttering? Do you think that this type of treatment might facilitate or support things like voluntary stuttering?
That's a really interesting question, actually. So our rationale for combining TDCS over the brain regions that we targeted and combining with a particular behavioral intervention was that both of them should really interact in a positive way. So we used a behavioral intervention that should increase activation in the left frontal regions of the brain that we know are supporting speech planning and speech execution. So we use behavioral interventions that should help activate those regions, and then we apply the TDCS to prime and kind of promote the activation in that brain region. So I think that rationale could be applied to pair any kind of intervention with a application over the brain, as long as you knew that the TDCS would be able to affect that brain region and you had kind of enough knowledge about where to be placing the electrodes. So I don't know enough about what happens in the brain when we're using voluntary stuttering. I think it's a really interesting question, though. And I think generally the research we're doing with TDCS, we have a long way to go in terms of finding optimal combinations. But I think because we know most about the speech motor system and how that's functioning a bit differently in people who stutter, that was a sensible place for us to start.
Yeah, that makes sense. And just to expand it a bit, or even something like a stuttering modification tool, like a pull out that I just demonstrated, where the person is stuttering, but they're working on moving through the stutter. I often combine that with voluntary stuttering, but it could also be combined with a more behavioral approach too. So many things to ask you. I want to remind everyone, this is Stutter Talk. I'm Peter Reitzes, here with Dr. Jennifer Chesters, who is at the Oxford Department of Experimental Psychology. She's a researcher and a speech language therapist.
You can call me Jen.
Jen, I will call you Jen. So whenever we do an episode on a pharmaceutical that's being researched, we have people contact us immediately and say, hey, where can I get paglicone? Someone's going to contact us and say, hey, I want to try this treatment. Do you think there are people who are doing this treatment outside of research, or do you think they should be, or how long will people have to wait to be able to try this treatment?
In terms of whether people are, I would be very surprised if they're not. I think there's a really active community of people who do what's sometimes known as DIY TDCS, so they make their own equipment. In terms of whether they should, I mean, I wouldn't, this is the only randomized controlled trial that's been published so far. It's on 30 people. I don't think that this is reason enough to go ahead and try it. I think it's a really positive starting point. We're really interested in where to go next with it, but there are lots of questions to be asked. I think there's some kind of simplifications of this idea that, oh, if I pumped up the intensity, then I would get a better result. And we know that that's not the case with TDCS. There are complex interactions in the brain, and our brains are very good at keeping themselves safe. So we're using a very, very low current for a short period of time, and that seems to be effective. If you boost up the current or lengthen the time, it's likely your brain is just going to balance itself out and make sure that it doesn't become out of control. So it actually would make the effect of the TDCS less or even reverse it. And I think we really need to use our ability to look at controlled studies of TDCS to find the best way forward and then roll it out when we know how to use it best. I think always there are people who are really intrigued and want to run with it, and we can't really stop that from happening. But I would advise against it.
So one of your colleagues who's been a guest on Stutter Talk, the researcher, Dr. Sue N. Chang, she's doing, I believe, similar research to yours at the University of Michigan. And I don't want to misspeak here, so I apologize in advance if I am wrong, but I think I read that she might be using a slightly higher current than you're using. I don't know if you want to comment on that at all.
Yeah, I think she is actually. I saw her at the I can't remember which conference I saw her at the ASHA conference.
We okay.
She invited me to speak there. I'm sorry, my memory. Yes, so they're using a slightly different type of TDCS. So as far as I understand, they're using high definition, which involves using slightly smaller electrodes and positioning them differently. So I think there are lots of options in terms of ways to stimulate and current intensities. We chose a 1 milliamp intensity, which is pretty much the lowest that you see studies using. I think some have used maybe 0.5 with just two pads or electrodes that are rather large. And we opted for that because we had done some preliminary research. So we did some research looking at speech motor control in people who don't stutter, and we compared two intensities and also some different electrode positionings. And we didn't find any additional benefit of using 2 milliamp over 1 milliamp. The benefit of using 1 milliamp is it was very easy to completely blind people to which condition they were in. Going to 2 milliamp, their kind of itch was slightly more. So we kind of, on balance, thought the benefits of 1 milliamp were better, and there was no real benefit of going higher. So we kind of thought we'll stay as low as we can go and still get a good effect. So that's our rationale. I'm not entirely sure of the overview of why the particular stimulation parameters we used for Sue N. Chang's team's research, but I'm really excited to see their outcomes.
Yes, me, and then you could compare them a bit too.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So overall, do you feel that this treatment research was, quote, successful for the subjects? And I just want to throw in that it was really interesting to read it because so with the reduction in stuttering for the read aloud group, I was putting myself back in when stuttering was really, really challenging for me. And I could see that slowing down to read might increase fluency or reduce stuttering, but not being able to change. So having to read the words on the page, not being able to change words might have increased my stuttering. So I was a little surprised. It was interesting. It was so clear that there was less stuttering with read aloud. So I'll just throw that comment out there, and I'll just ask you, do you think that this was overall a successful treatment?
Well, I think in terms of our the outcomes and our rationale for doing the intervention, we were looking at whether or not we could enhance a kind of fluent mode of speaking. And we did find that we could. In terms of kind of whether it was a treatment that the participants found useful and clinically significant, I don't think that's what we were really aiming for with this first study. We were looking for whether this was a clinically interesting thing to pursue. So in terms of the reading, yeah, I think it was really interesting that we found this effect on the reading. And I kind of mentioned before, maybe it has to do with the sensitivity of reading to pick up those changes in fluency for just the reasons you're talking about. You can't swap out words. I think our participants did comment that they found it quite positive to have the experience of speaking with the fluency enhancing behavioral techniques, and particularly for people who had more severe stuttering, to have that experience of just sounding quite fluent when reading for a bit was novel and quite interesting. And most of our participants felt overall kind of better, as the psychosocial measure showed, just generally from taking part in the study, and felt that their speech was more fluent. So from that point of view, I think it was a positive outcome and in terms of us then using it as a jumping off point for further research, I think it was absolutely a positive outcome.
And let me know if I got this right, but it sounds like you were using the choral speech and the metronome time speech, not because they're the best treatments available, but because they would quickly bring a high level of fluency, a high reduction of stuttering, so that you could get to the stimulation effect to see if that would have a difference. Is that correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. That was our rationale. So, of course, using choral speech and metronome time speech aren't particularly useful approaches clinically, but they do exactly as you say. The vast majority of people who stutter, you will get this immediate and almost complete fluency. And we wanted the TDCS to interact with kind of what we called a fluent mode of speaking. So just meaning that the brain network supporting speech were supporting fluent speech. So we were upregulating the left inferior kind of frontal regions of the brain, which we know are critical for fluent speaking. We wanted to have that combination of engaging that network with a behavioral intervention, having a relatively effortless fluent speech output, and then interacting with TDCS over those brain regions. In the future, I mean, another option would have been to go through a period of therapy that lasted longer, go towards the end stages of an intervention, for example, using kind of more traditional kind of fluency shaping, or any therapy where you'd expect a shift in fluency, and then applying TDCS towards the end. But of course, that would have involved a longer period of intervention, and there would potentially have been more variability in the success for each participant. So for a first study, it's basically a shortcut to fluent speaking that we went for, which worked quite well for us.
That's fascinating. And I'll just plant a seed that if you get to the stages where you're looking at, shall we say, more advanced types of behavioral treatments, it would be interesting if one of your treatment groups was something like the Successful Stuttering Management Program, where when I went through it as a clinician, there was a lot of work on speaking, but it was more in the realm of stuttering modification, of stuttering differently, as opposed to fluency shaping. So it'd be really interesting how this type of stimulation would affect different types of stuttering treatments.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. It would be really interesting to take it forward in that way. And I mean, of course, this approach really sits in a whole kind of spectrum of approaches towards supporting people who stutter. And one way of supporting people who stutter is actually to do nothing with their speech at all. I mean, we're very much pro choice and being able to offer the most effective interventions that we can, whichever kind of direction people want to take their stuttering therapy, or whether they choose to have none at all. In terms of how TDCS fits into that picture, I think there's lots to be looked at, and I would be also very interested in pairing it with a very different approach towards therapy.
So there was something towards the end of your study that I thought was really interesting. So I think I'm going to quote it here. Your study noted that the positive outcome of this trial has relevance more broadly to the application of TDCS to speech and language disorders, both acquired and developmental. So are you thinking that this research on stuttering might one day help children with, let's say, a developmental articulation delay or developmental language disorder?
Yeah, so I guess the kind of easiest link you could make would be for another condition that affects speech planning and speech execution. So because we were placing the electrodes over regions involved in speech planning and execution, and also kind of monitoring speech feedback, those regions are implicated in more speech and language conditions than just stuttering. So I guess I was thinking along the apraxia level, the apraxia type of condition, but also articulation disorders with a different basis. And there has been research done in kind of acquired language disorders, but also kind of developmental language disorders may benefit from this approach. So I think, yeah, in terms of where we were targeting and how we were kind of enhancing the speech network behaviorally, it does have implications for other speech and language conditions. So it'd be interesting to see where that goes from here.
Yeah, and as long as we're throwing ideas around, I would love to see how this might or might not affect someone who speaks with a lot of normal disfluencies. Because we have a bunch of people in my family who do not stutter. They've never stuttered, but they speak with a ton of revisions and sentence breaks. And I wonder how it would affect the flow of speech and the flow of language in non-stuttering speakers.
I think this is a really interesting question. And we were actually counting not just what would be considered as moments of stuttering, but other moments of disfluency, and did find an effect on both other kinds of disfluencies and things that would be more considered kind of core stuttering characteristics. So we would expect that there could be some change in those other disfluencies. Mm.
So I've got one more question for you, and then the last question will just be, is there anything you'd like to say that you haven't said yet? But I did note that your study excluded people who were, quote, mild stutterers and people who had other issues like concomitant language disorders. So I would have definitely been excluded from this study because I was very covert. So I was what you might call mild. I don't like that term, but I know what you mean. And I had learning disabilities. So do you think that this, at some point, you'll move towards accepting a wider range of stutterers?
Yeah, that would absolutely be our plan. And we're doing another study we started last November, where we have, in terms of the severity that we're expecting, we have widened out, not very much actually yet, because we're kind of building step by step. But the reason that we went with people who had a more severe stutter is that if you just have less moments of stuttering in your speech, it's harder to see the effect of the TDCS, because by chance you might just not stutter at all on a given day. So we were really looking at having a group who are as similar as possible in their characteristics and who would give us as much sensitivity as possible to see whether TDCS did anything, because it was the first time we were looking, and we didn't want to find no effect but not know whether that's because we weren't ever able to measure it properly. But I think it would be really important to then open it up and look. The other exclusion criteria we had, of course, is we only did the intervention with men who stutter. And that, again, was to do with keeping the group as similar as possible. And, of course, four or five times as many men than women stutter. So it was just the easiest approach to just go for a group of men who stutter. I would be really interested to look at whether there were similar effects in women or whether there were interesting differences. I think there's lots that we need to investigate in terms of how the differences that are a brain level might look different for women who stutter compared to men who stutter, because they're quite often excluded from neuroscience research, not because we're not interested in them, but because they're a really small group and we need to gather together enough women who stutter to be able to see those differences.
Yeah, those are all excellent points. And, you know, as we're talking about this, I'm remembering that with the auditory feedback devices like the Speakeasy, there was a time where it seemed that everybody was trying or interested in getting some type of auditory delayed feedback onto phones or onto pocket devices. And I'm just thinking aloud here, I'm wondering if there's people who are listening saying, hey, I'd like to figure how to get this current into my iPhone so I could, you know, I'm not telling anyone to do that. Please don't misunderstand. I just know how, like, I had one stuttering friend who was always trying to toy with these things. And I can see people like trying to do this at home, as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is a very interesting question how delayed auditory feedback would interact with this, with TDCS. Because, I mean, in terms of kind of inducing a more kind of fluent mode of speaking, and also in terms of shifting the way that the speech network's working, it does similar things to the techniques that we used in the study. So I think there are so many interesting questions to be followed up, of course, not by people tinkering with their iPhone, but I mean, I can see why it really piques people's interest.
And I realize there's one question I meant to ask you and I forgot. So just let me ask this. There's something that I learned in speech therapy, which was to be responsible for my own stuttering, to stop running away from my stuttering, to allow myself to stutter on purpose, to stutter differently, to change how I think about stuttering. And so this all took me from, and by the way, you'll notice I didn't say anything about fluency. That's just my preference. So this helped me get from feelings of helplessness to feelings of I'm strong, I can do something with my stuttering, even on those tough days. Do you have any concern that a current stimulation like this could somehow feed into feelings of helplessness or I don't have to be responsible for my stuttering? I'm not trying to blame stutterers or anything. It's just I learned how to be active in my change in treatment. Mm. So are you worried about any type of learned helplessness from such treatments?
So really interesting question. It's one that I've not been asked before, actually. So I guess what we were aiming for with the intervention is to kind of have an effortless fluency. And that kind of does involve asking people to not really do anything. So they weren't having to modify anything about their speaking in terms of trying to stutter less. They were just speaking under conditions that are likely to just make them stutter less. And I think in terms of our rationale for the approach we were using and how we thought TDCS was working, that was important. So from that point of view, I guess there isn't space really for that idea of taking responsibility for your speech. But I don't think that we are thinking of TDCS being used as a stuttering intervention in isolation from anything else. I think we're really thinking clinically it would be used holistically. And this idea of taking responsibility and also just feeling like it's absolutely okay to stutter is such an important part of intervention for the most people who do stutter who seek out therapy. So I don't think it's at odds with that message, but I think it's just a matter of saying, oh, in those moments that you might want to be more fluent, let's see at giving you that option in the most efficient way we can. I think it's really interesting that you said that you don't use the term fluency, and I've listened to previous podcasts and I totally understand that. I think the intervention that we were looking at really was just looking at whether or not we could improve fluency with no value judgment there in terms of whether you'd want to chase improved fluency. And I think for a lot of people it makes them not happy to try and stay fluent. It depends why you want to be fluent, but I think there's absolutely a place and people justify why they need fluency in certain situations. And I think it's an individual choice and something that we want to allow anybody to have if they choose to go for fluency. We'd like them to have the best outcome that they could possibly have. That was a very long-winded answer. I'm sorry.
No, it was really great. And I certainly wanted to stutter less. I still do. I don't want to be out of control with my stuttering. I respect folks who don't care and they just think it's okay to stutter. I mean, I think it's okay to stutter. I just also want to have control over my stuttering. And we have a lot of listeners who say, I want fluency.
Yes. Yeah.
So promise, last question for Dr. Jennifer Chesters. Is there anything you haven't had a chance to say yet or you'd like to reiterate about a transcranial direct current stimulation?
I guess really we just see it as being one option in a whole kind of toolbox of options that we'd want people who stutter to have. So I think we've kind of covered that one.
Yeah.
And also the fact that it's very comfortable and very safe. And we're not aiming in any way to kind of do anything extreme or shocking to people's brains. Other than that, I think we've really covered everything. I've really enjoyed chatting to you. Thank you.
Awesome. So I want to thank you, Dr. Jennifer Chesters, for joining us today from the United Kingdom.
Thank you very much for having me.